Good afternoon. This is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, June 4th. Let's start with the front page. From Valerie Wells in Decatur, Lake Decatur set to roar, boat racing. We have a photo of Sean Bowser making adjustments to his hydroplane in preparation for Hardy's race for the lake at his home in Cisco on Monday, June 2nd. The Lake Decatur boat races will be Saturday and Sunday, June 7th and 8th at Nelson Park. Track's reputation attracts accolades, boats for a packed weekend of racing. After a 20-year absence, the boat races returned to Decatur in 2024, largely thanks to a grant from Dan Hardy. This year they're back again, starting at 10 a.m. Saturday and Sunday, June 7th and 8th, in Nelson Park. After Lake Decatur was named Race Site of the Year by the American Powerboat Association, out of 130 race sites, local racer Sean Bowser said, "Decatur's bid to host the Eastern Divisional this year and the Nationals next year, and was successful in both bids." Decatur has a rich history in boat racing going back to the 1950s up through 2004. The last year, the boat races were held in Decatur. People remember the good times, and I think we brought it back to them. He ran his first race in Decatur, he said, after growing up around boat racing. "I was born in boat racing," he said. "I'm from Kankakee, and we have boat racing there. I watched from our backyard on the river. We used to come to Decatur, my dad and I, in the 70s and 80s. The racing boats can reach 160 miles an hour in a straightaway, he said, and racers are coming to these races from 17 states and Canada. Lake Decatur's basins are well suited for boat races, he said. The facilities are nice, and with the judges' tower down there, there's an awesome asset, he said. The water is big and open, though when the wind blows, it can be a pain. We set a record there last year, and records are hard to set. Some of them still stand from the 90s. For spectators, parking will be available along Lakeshore Drive, which will be closed to traffic starting 5 a.m. Friday, June 5th, until 5 a.m. Monday, June 9th. Parking costs $5, and shuttles will be available to take spectators to Nelson Park and back to their cars. Enter from Lost Bridge Road, 16th Street. No overnight parking will be allowed. There also will be live-streamed coverage on nowdecatur.com. The Decatur Park District, as the host for the event, is pleased to see the enthusiasm for the return of boat racing, said Executive Director Clay Gerard. "I think for me it was clear last year when we teamed up with Sean Bowser and Terry Hamill and the City of Decatur, with the Park District the overarching sponsor of the event. It was clear to me when we had that many boaters sign up," Gerhardt said. And the comments, "I used to love racing here and I'm so glad to be back in Decatur." It was surprising, when it had been 20 years, that a lot of racers or kids of racers remembered, and to hear their comments about being excited to come back. It speaks to the quality of the lake, the setup of the race course, and all the logistics. It's a lot of moving parts, and the Park District is already having a very busy summer with a lot of large events, Gerhardt said, joking that he's living at Nelson Park for now. The races aren't a moneymaker for the Park District, he said. Thanks to Dan Hardy, we got a grant for several years, Gerhardt said. Eventually, we have to make this self-sufficient. When you buy a drink or food, that money goes back into the boat race budget for the next year. Most racers, Bowser said, race only as a hobby and have regular jobs the rest of the time. In a given race weekend, he only races for 40 minutes, four heats of 10 minutes each. But one of the reasons he loves the sport is the friendships he's made and getting to see those friends at events. "We're all friends. We all get along," he said. "We'd rather beat you on the water than on the beach." Again from the front page, from Brendan Moore, Decatur Council okays $14 million rideshare service. Decatur moved one step closer to the rollout of a new microtransit system that Economic and Community Development Director Lacey Elsey hailed as an Uber or a rideshare program that anybody can use. The Decatur City Council on Monday unanimously approved a three-year, $14 million contract with Dallas-based MV Transportation Incorporated to manage and operate the service, which is scheduled to launch on July 1st. The contract will be funded with a combination of state and federal transportation operating grants and a congressional appropriation secured by Senator Dick Durbin, according to city officials. In simple terms, microtransit is a first-mile, last-mile solution that utilizes smaller branded vehicles to take riders from a designated stop near their homes to either stops near their final destinations or to fixed-route buses that could be used to complete their trips. Microtransit is an efficient, cost-effective, data-driven opportunity that is going to allow us to serve areas that necessarily don't make sense to operate fixed routes in, Elsie said. It is also viewed as a solution to gaps in coverage in existing rideshare service from companies like Uber and Lyft. Similar to those services, riders will be able to set up microtransit trips via an app on their smartphone. There also will be a designated number people can call to arrange a ride. While MV did not submit the lowest bid, city officials said the company submitted the most responsive and complete proposal. And since the company has managed and operated the city's fixed route and paratransit bus system since 2014, the transition should be seamless. Microtransit is a piece of a larger transformation of the city's public transportation system that aims to improve connectivity within the region. Earlier this year, the city extended the hours fixed route buses operate to 8:15 p.m. daily. It also expanded Sunday bus service, brought back on a limited basis in 2022, after a 60-year hiatus, to include all routes. Transit officials have also explored truncating and streamlining bus routes to focus on the city center and connections to the city's major commercial centers. Though this would reduce the reach of the city's buses, it would free up resources for more frequent service on the routes that remain while the fleet of about 24 microtransit vehicles would fill in the gaps. In February, the city also linked intergovernmental agreements with Forsyth and Mount Zion to take over public transit operations in those cities, while also agreeing to take over transit services in rural parts of Macon County. Service to both Decatur suburbs and rural Macon County is expected to lean heavily on microtransit. In other action, the council approved a $149,500 grant agreement with the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity to cover part of the costs of a preliminary engineering services for a possible pipeline from the DeWitt well fields to a site eyed for economic development on the city's northeast side. The city earlier this year received a $3 million grant from DCEO to help cover the costs of planning and constructing a 1.1-mile water main extension from Brush College Road north to Cundiff Road. The main would service land north of Interstate 72 that is viewed as prime for economic development. However, Public Works Director Matt Newell said Monday that some of the development opportunities we're looking at that site needed more water than what the city could provide. Purchased by the city in 1988, the DeWitt well fields serve as a secondary water source that the city can draw upon during times of drought. And our last article from the front page, from AP business writer Matt Ott, Washington, D.C. Energy. Meta to buy power from Clinton. Deal to ensure 20 more years of operation. Meta has cut a 20-year deal to secure nuclear power from Constellation Energy's facility in Clinton to help meet surging demand for artificial intelligence and other computing needs. As part of the agreement with Facebook's parent company, Clinton's clean energy output will expand by 30 megawatts, preserve 1,100 local jobs, and bring in $13.5 million in annual tax revenue, according to the companies. Additionally, Constellation said it would donate $1 million to Clinton area nonprofits over 5 years. The area, announced Tuesday, is just the latest in a string of tech nuclear partnerships as the use of AI expands. Financial details of the agreement were not disclosed. The Constellation plant, now called the Clinton Clean Energy Center, was slated to close in 2017 after years of financial losses, but was saved by legislation in Illinois establishing a zero-emission credit program to support the plant into 2027. The agreement deal takes effect in June of 2027 when the state's taxpayer-funded zero-emission credit program expires. Securing clean, reliable energy is necessary to continue advancing our AI ambitions, said Irvi Parekh, Meta's head of global energy. Surging investments in small nuclear reactors comes at a time when large tech companies are facing two major demands: a need to increase their energy supply for AI and data centers, among other needs, while also trying to significantly cut greenhouse gas emissions. Those emissions are generated in large part from the burning of fossil fuels like gasoline, oil, and coal. Nuclear energy, while producing waste, does not emit carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases. Constellation, the owner of the shuttered Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, said in September that it planned to restart the reactor so tech giant Microsoft could secure power to supply its data centers. Three Mile Island, located on the Susquehanna River just outside Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, was the site of the nation's worst commercial nuclear power accident in 1979. Also last fall, Amazon said it was investing in small nuclear reactors 2 days after a similar announcement by Google. Additionally, Google announced last month that it was investing in three advanced nuclear energy projects with Elemental Power. U.S. states have been positioning themselves to meet the tech industry's power needs as policymakers consider expanding subsidies and gutting regulatory obstacles. Last year, 25 states passed legislation to support advanced nuclear energy, and lawmakers this year have introduced over 200 bills supportive of nuclear energy, according to the trade association Nuclear Energy Institute. Advanced reactor designs from competing firms are filling up the federal government's regulatory pipeline, as the industry touts them as reliable, climate-friendly way to meet electricity demands from tech giants, desperate to power their fast-growing artificial intelligence platforms. Amazon, Google, and Microsoft also have been investing in solar and wind technologies, which make electricity without producing greenhouse gas emissions. Shares of Constellation Energy Corp., based in Baltimore, were flat Tuesday. Now we'll turn to local and state news from page A3. From Donette Beckett in Decatur, we have interest up in Fair Queen pageant. After several years of dwindling participation, the Miss Macon County Fair Queen pageant is set to return to the bigger grandstand stage with more contestants and a new leader. The pageant will begin at 6 p.m. Thursday, June 5th at the Macon County Fairground. Admission is $7. I've had a lot of really great help from past directors and past queens, and we've got a pageant crew which I'm thankful for, said Brooke Burke. It takes a lot of hard work and dedication. Although she took part in several pageants as a child, this is Burke's first time serving as a pageant director. The most recent pageants have been sparse with only two queen contestants. The low turnout moved the event to a smaller building located on the Macon County Fairground. With eight queen contestants and the return of the Junior Miss and Little Miss contests, with 11 and 7 contestants respectively, the larger grandstand stage was needed. Miss contestants are Emery Bunselmeyer, Aurora Cobrin, Kylie Curtis, Anya Ireland, Bailey Menser, Mackenzie Spitzer, Jaden Starr, and Alyssa Wicks. All the contestants are photos in the paper today as well. Junior Miss contestants are Penelope Baker, Elise Brown, Kelsey Hannell, Rogan Parker, Addison Rogers, Olivia Rogers, Lillian Smith, Britlin Sturgeon, Amada Voiles, Quinn Wagahoff, and Kennedy Warnsley. Little contestants are Lila Hunter, Wrigley Jones, Kingsley Joyner, Tabitha Lamb, Elliot Marsh, Skylin Oliver, and Aurora Yancey. Burke credits social media for the increased participation. "I think it targeted the audience we were meaning to target," she said. The Little Miss division includes girls ages 4 to 8 years old, Junior Miss contestants range in age from 10 to 14, and the Miss division includes young women from 16 to 21 years old. "But our oldest contestant is 18 years old," Burke said. Macon County isn't the only region that will be represented. Three Junior Miss contestants are from Sangamon County, since the area doesn't host a pageant for that age group. There also is a Miss contestant from La Place. "It's a little far for some girls, but we're blessed that they're taking the time and giving it an opportunity," Burke said. "They've been super dedicated and committed to the process. We've got a great group of girls near and far." The girls have been practicing twice a week since April to prepare for the judges as well as perfect their stage performance. The competition will begin before the girls meet the audience. All 26 contestants will meet the judges for the interview process at a nearby church. This is how the judges get to know them one-on-one, Burke said. At 6 p.m., the pageant will begin the Little Miss contestants, followed by the Junior Miss and Queen competitions. The new queen will receive a $1,000 scholarship to be used towards education expenses. She will spend her year-long reign representing Macon County at various events, including 6 volunteer events and with one being an agriculture-related activity, and will compete in the Miss Illinois County Fair state pageant in January. Burke said she sees this event as an opportunity for future contestants to learn more about the process. It's really not competitive like people think it is, she said. They've been able to meet new people and make new friends. They've been forming super strong bonds with each other. Wednesday at the fair, Senior Day. Free admission for those 65 and older with identification. Gates open 3 to 10 p.m. Downstate Classic Harness Racing 4:30 p.m. Grandstand Junior and Open Rabbit Show judging beginning at 6 p.m. Rabbit Show Barn. And now our title from our opinion page. Deduction Redux. Lift cap, but make liberal states pay their own way. From Alex Zenos, who's an attorney and writer. As Republicans work to advance their mega bill, the debate over the $10,000 cap on the federal deduction for state and local taxes is again heating up. GOP lawmakers from high-tax blue states facing pressure from constituents burdened by aggressive state and local tax regimes have been lobbying President Donald Trump and Republican leadership to repeal the cap or raise it. On May 22nd, the House passed a bill increasing the cap to $40,000 for individuals earning up to $500,000, gradually decreasing for those with higher incomes. However, conservative critics argue that raising the cap would amount to a federal subsidy for profligate Democratic governance. That was a view I once shared, and it's not wrong, at least in the context of the decayed federal system we inhabit. The current debate is a system of a much larger problem. What deserves scrutiny is the entire framework of federal subsidies propping up state-level irresponsibility. Rather than defend the cap, conservatives should consider turning the state and local tax deduction into a tool, a wedge, to start restoring federalism. Thus, this moment presents an opportunity to help move the nation closer to how our federal system was initially supposed to function. I would remove the cap altogether. A tax policy that allows for the full deductibility of state and local taxes could help shift the tax burden back to the states where it belongs. States would be incentivized to raise their revenue without increasing the burden on their residents. That could reduce the amount of money being funneled to Washington. If states pick up more slack in governing, the federal government can and should begin to scale back correspondingly. If blue states want to pursue extravagant projects and progressive experiments, let them do so, but with their tax dollars. Restoring the full local tax deduction could shift the political accountability for taxation away from Congress and back toward governors, mayors, and state legislatures. Voters in New York and California would still feel the pinch, but the pinch would come from Albany and Sacramento. In that environment, voters may demand better governance from their officials, or they might not. Either way, the federal government would be less involved in state governance, and the incentives for local self-government would be more substantial. None of this matters if the federal government continues ignoring deficits. It should make it easier for fiscal hawks in Washington to push budget cuts. More responsibility must be put back on the states where it belongs and where it once was. Rebalancing the fiscal relationship between the states and the federal government isn't just a question of efficiency, it's a constitutional imperative. The federal government was never meant to equalize outcomes between states with vastly different economies, cultures, and priorities. For too long, conservatives have fought battles over tax policy without rethinking the deeper structure of federalism. We've tried to make Washington fairer. The answer is to make it smaller and to let the states rise or fall on their own merits. That means targeting federal aid to the states for reduction, considering those states that tax their residents the most and have chosen expansive spending agendas. In short, let high-tax states live within their means. Then over time, we should dismantle all unnecessary subsidies, and grants. The federal government should not be redistributing tax dollars from one state to another for local services that should be funded and managed locally. The state and local tax deduction won't fix our tax code. However, it could be used to help rebalance our constitutional order. And for conservatives, that should count for something. Conservatives are right to be skeptical of policies to benefit blue state elites, but they shouldn't overlook opportunities to restore accountability and shrink the federal footprint. The real fight isn't just about deductions, it's about dependency. Washington can no longer afford to be the state's Santa Claus. Let the states compete. Let them succeed or fail on their terms. And let the American people see clearly who's delivering results. We'll read the second half of the opinion page in part two. Stay tuned. From our food page today, we have Hot Grill Summer, How to Cook the Perfect Steak, Marks and All, with great instructions on how to get a beautiful steak done exactly to your liking, and a recipe for compound butter, garlic parmesan flavors, which you add to meat while it rests and place a bit of the butter atop it. Let the butter melt as the meat is resting to serve. Now from our Nation and World page, immigration authorities detain suspect's family, from the Associated Press in Boulder, Colorado. Man accused of attack in Colorado says no one knew of his plan. Federal immigration authorities detained the wife and five children of the man accused of throwing Molotov cocktails at demonstrators in Boulder, who called for the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza, injuring 12 of them, officials said. Mohammed Sabri Solomon, who was disguised as a gardener, had 18 Molotov cocktails and planned to kill all the demonstrators, but apparently had second thoughts, throwing just two during Sunday's attack, in which he yelled, "Free Palestine," police said. Solomon, 45, didn't carry out his full plan because he got scared and had never hurt anyone before, police wrote in an affidavit. The two incendiary devices he threw at the group of about 20 people were enough to injure more than half of them, and authorities said he expressed no regrets about the attack. Federal officials are investigating whether Solomon's family knew about the plan, U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem said on social media. Solomon, an Egyptian national who is in the U.S. illegally, according to officials, told authorities no one knew about his plans, according to documents. From the Associated Press in Washington, D.C., Lisa Mascaro and Mary Claire Jelonek. Trump presses senators. President wants bill of tax breaks, spending cuts on his desk July 4th. President Donald Trump wants his bill of tax breaks and spending cuts on his desk to be signed into law by the 4th of July, and he's pushing the slow-rolling Senate to make it happen sooner rather than later. Trump met with Senate Majority Leader John Thune at the White House early this week and called senators for one-on-one chats, using both the carrot and stick to nudge, badger, and encourage them to act. But it's still a long road ahead for the 1,000-page-plus package. It's a potentially tumultuous 3-week sprint for senators preparing to put their own imprint on the massive Republican package that cleared the House late last month by a single vote. The senators met for weeks behind closed doors, including as they returned to Washington late Monday, to revise the package ahead of what is expected to be a similarly narrow vote in the Senate. But Trump's high-octane ally billionaire, Elon Musk, lambasted the package and those voting for it. "This massive, outrageous, pork-filled congressional spending bill is a disgusting abomination," Musk posted on his social media site, as some lawmakers expressed reservations about the details. Thune, like House Speaker Mike Johnson, has few votes to spare from the Senate's slim 53-seat GOP majority. Democrats are waging an all-out political assault on GOP proposals to cut Medicaid, food stamps, and green energy investments to help pay for more than $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, with many lawmakers being hammered at boisterous town halls back home. "It'd be nice if we could have everybody on board to do it, but you know, individual members are going to stake out their positions," Thune said Tuesday. "But in the end, we have to succeed. Failure's not an option." At its core, the package seeks to extend the tax cuts approved in 2017, during Trump's first term at the White House. and add new ones the president campaigned on, including no taxes on tips and others. It also includes a massive buildup of $350 billion for border security, deportations, and national security. To defray the lost tax revenue to the government and avoid piling onto the nation's $36 trillion debt load, Republicans want to reduce federal spending by imposing work requirements for some Americans who rely on government safety net services. The package would also raise the nation's debt limit by $4 trillion to allow more borrowing to pay the bills. Now from our National Digest. Protest in Minneapolis targets police action. Dozens of protesters converged in the heart of the Latino community in Minneapolis on Tuesday after a large force of federal and local authorities wearing tactical gear conducted what they called a law enforcement action. The protesters flocked to the area near a Mexican restaurant and other Latino-owned businesses after seeing live streams that claimed an immigration raid was underway, reflecting opposition to such raids in a city that declared itself a sanctuary for migrants. However, statements from local authorities said it was not an immigration enforcement matter, but a criminal case. While we are still gathering details, this incident was related to a criminal search warrant for drugs and money laundering, and it was not related to immigration enforcement, Mayor Jacob Frey said in a Facebook post. No arrests were made. Train derailment. A specialized plane equipped with advanced sensors could have helped authorities avoid needlessly blowing open five rail tank cars and burning their toxic contents after the disastrous 2023 East Palestine, Ohio train derailment, according to a report released Tuesday by the EPA's Inspector General. But the agency's on-scene coordinator misunderstood the capabilities of the plane, the report said. From the Ukraine war, a Russian rocket attack targeted the northeastern Ukrainian city of Sumy on Tuesday, killing at least four people and wounding 25, officials said. Student loans. Borrowers who defaulted on their federal student loans will no longer be at risk of having their Social Security benefits garnished, an Education Department spokesperson said Tuesday. The government restarted collections last month for the millions of people in default on their loans. Immigration. Newark Mayor Ross Baraka sued New Jersey's top federal prosecutor, Alina Haba, Tuesday over his arrest on a trespassing charge at a federal immigration detention facility, saying she pursued the case out of political spite. From Washington, Trump asks Congress to claw back spending. The White House officially asked Congress to claw back $9.4 billion in already approved spending Tuesday, taking funding away from programs targeted by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. It's a process known as rescission, which requires President Donald Trump to get approval from Congress to return money that previously was appropriated. Trump's aides claim the funding cuts target programs that promote liberal ideologies. The request, if it passes the House and Senate, would formally enshrine many of the spending cuts and the freezes sought by DOGE. Today in history. On this date, in 1919, Congress approved the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which said that the right of Americans to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The amendment was then sent to the states for ratification. On this date in 1940, during World War II, the Allied military completed the evacuation of more than 338,000 troops from Dunkirk, France. Also in 1940, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill declared in a speech to the House of Commons, "We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender." We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, June 4th. Please stay tuned.